This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota. As the pandemic rages and the election nears, healthcare is getting a lot of attention. Today we're going to share a discussion about one very pricey aspect of our healthcare system, prescription drugs. In the 1990s, Congress passed a law regulating the cost of some prescriptions. Now, Connecticut Attorney General William Tong is going after pharmaceutical companies he says are violating that law. He visited with Conversations on Healthcare podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter.
Attorney General Tong, we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you both. Glad to join you.
Well, Attorney General Tong, I think you know that community health centers provide quality, affordable healthcare to 30 million of the nation's vulnerable populations, and critical to that mission is securing affordable life-saving drugs for low-income patients. In 1992, Congress passed the 340B drug pricing program. It makes life-saving drugs affordable to millions. Recently, some major drug manufacturers have issued some very restrictive protocols that will undermine the integrity of that program and potentially put many lives at risk. You've sent requests to a number of these drug makers demanding they abandon these actions, threatening access to affordable prescriptions. I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners more about that.
When Congress can get together on important legislation as it did in 1992, can really make a huge difference in the lives of people and their access to healthcare. Not just life-saving, but life-enabling drugs, right? The drugs and medicines and pharmaceuticals that we rely on every day. It's not just drugs for major heart conditions or cancer. It's the antibiotics that we take. It's the drugs that people need to have a good and strong quality of life and health for themselves and their families. And so Congress made a determination now almost 30 years ago that it was going to help community health centers, safety net hospitals, various other types of clinics that help targeted populations pay for and afford these drugs that every year get ever more expensive. For reasons that I cannot discern, major drug companies, including AstraZeneca and Eli Lilly and Sanofi, have decided to cut us out of that program, cut community health centers out of that program unilaterally. Very little explanation given as to why they've done that. Not clear what's going on here. It appears that they're adding new conditions to the program. So were they to resume providing drugs at a discounted price under 340B, they require extensive new information from community health centers about you and your business model and also your patients. At the urging of you and your colleagues and many other healthcare providers that need this lifeline 340B, I sent a letter to a number of manufacturers asking them, what's going on here? Why have you cut communities, not just community health centers, but communities? You appear to be breaking the law. It is contrary to the 340B law passed by Congress, and I want an explanation. And that's usually how this starts. An attorney general, my job is to protect consumers and to protect the people in my state. Mm-hmm. If I don't get a satisfactory response, that's when I look at all the range of actions and options that are at my disposal as attorney general, and I can take the next step. Sometimes that includes further investigation, could include a lawsuit, could include, and this is where you really see AGs in action, linking arms with other AGs, as we did in Big Tobacco, as we're doing in my generic drug price fixing case, and taking action as a multi-state and coordinated coalition.
Mm-hmm. What's the motivation from the industry and also from the White House that issued that executive order at this point?
Money. I can tell you that based on my experience confronting, taking on the big pharmaceutical companies, not just in this space, in terms of 340B, but in the generic drug price fixing case, in my work on opioids, I am on the National Executive Committee of Attorneys General fighting the opioid crisis. We unfortunately see a preponderance, a significant number of major companies, pharmaceutical companies across the country, across the globe, who in these respects are bad actors and have broken the law. And from what I can tell, it's motivated by their bottom line and a desire to maximize their profits. I have no other explanation. I hope they can give me one.
Your role as an attorney general is protecting the people in your state. For health centers or patients across the country, how might they approach their own attorney general's office?
I get a phone call from a community health center and they say, we're under attack by some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies on earth. We need you to help us, right? My response is, how can I help? That plays out over and over again with our constituents who call and say, for example, I went down to buy hand sanitizer at my local convenience store, and I think they're gouging us in the middle of the pandemic, right? They're charging us $30 for a bottle of hand sanitizer. I say, how can I help, right? I send an investigator down to check it out. I send a letter to the big pharmaceutical companies to check it out. That's how it started with General Blumenthal more than 20 years ago, when people said, you really ought to help us stop this epidemic of youth smoking and the targeting of young people. It's more than 20 years ago, because I was targeted. I was a generation of kids that were targeted by appealing advertising. Joe Camel was the character that Camel cigarettes used to target young people to get us to smoke. And General Blumenthal joined with 45 other attorneys general across the country and brought the biggest multi-state consumer protection action in history, which resulted in the biggest multi-billion dollar settlement in history. And we've since cut smoking by half in this country. And people generally regard the big tobacco case as the big bang in attorney general multi-state coordination. The generic drug price fixing case, that was also pretty simple. A couple of lawyers in our office read an article in the New York Times about a heart drug, Digoxin, in the New York Times, and how it had shot up 500% over a couple of years. And they took the article upstairs to my predecessor, George Jeffs, and they said, George, this is weird. Can we look at this? And George said, go ahead, let's do it. And that started now a 49-state coalition taking on what I have called the largest corporate cartel in American history, the generic drug industry, which I have very strong evidence is engaged in a widespread conspiracy to fix prices and divide market share in violation of our state and federal antitrust laws. The final thing I say is, of course, opioids. I don't have to tell you where that comes from. That comes from the tremendous pain and suffering and death and destruction that we see in our communities. We lose 1,000 people a year and growing. We lose more than $10 billion in terms of economic damage from the opioid and addiction crisis. I hear all the time from families, from survivors, from victims about how they were targeted by opioid manufacturers, distributors, retailers, healthcare providers. I am ashamed to say that one of the prime bad actors in the opioid industry is a Connecticut-based company in my home city of Stamford, Purdue Pharma. That means to me that I have a special responsibility and obligation to be aggressive. Joined with almost every other state, we're taking on the addiction industry. And that comes from people that we're fighting for who are suffering every day. To answer your question, it happens any number of ways, but it usually happens by somebody picking up the phone or sending us an email and saying, we got a problem.
It strikes me that healthcare is one of those areas that people often don't really understand these issues until they are personally affected by it. And if you have great health insurance, low copays, not that many plans like that around anymore, low deductibles, and if you're very healthy, you might be spared firsthand knowledge of how bad the issue of pricing is in the industry. And I remember a couple of years ago, the congressional hearings when the cost of an EpiPen, something not optional for a family that has a child with serious allergies to have, one at home, one at school, shot up to, I think, $400 or more. And some action was taken. But we seem to be unique in America in this particular problem. If you have any thoughts about what other countries do to not have this issue of making drugs unaffordable, to people who absolutely need them. Have you looked at other models around the world or other first world countries?
Yeah, it's really hard to extrapolate one answer, right? There are obviously countries like Canada and the United Kingdom that have a much more nationalized government-sponsored or government-run or government-encouraged healthcare system. We've all engaged in these policy debates on what's better, what are the pluses and minuses, right? The argument that people in our country wouldn't want the type of healthcare that's provided in those countries or wouldn't stand for the waiting or the lack of comprehensive care. You know, frankly, it's hard for any of us to know because you read about it, but we don't live in those countries. We don't experience it. And healthcare, for example, in other places, particularly in Asia, can be a matter of cash and carry. If you've got money, you can get healthcare. If you don't have money, good luck. And so that's certainly not a system I think that anybody believes that we should have in this country would be very destructive. I think the overall, the real challenge is that there isn't enough accountability in our healthcare system. People are unchecked and untethered. I mean, let me just say that in the generic drug industry, generic drugs account for 90% of our nation's prescriptions, 90%. And when you say maybe some of us can get away without feeling the effects of this, I doubt there are very many people that haven't taken a generic drug at some point or another in the past 6 months or a year. I do. I have rosacea, which I share with the nation on 60 Minutes. Okay. And it requires a basic antibiotic called doxycycline, which was developed before I was born.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. The time period for recouping the cost of developing that drug have long since passed. Yeah. Okay. And that drug decade ago was like, you know, $40, $20, right? It shot up 8,000%.
Right.
There's no reason for that. Right. Why is Digoxin 8,000% more expensive than it was a decade ago? Another drug, I hope I pronounce it correctly, metronidazole is a topical, again, skin ointment that used for inflammation. I also have that. It's made by a generic drug manufacturer named Taro, which I have sued. And that drug has shot up a considerable amount over the past few years. And I have emails, phone records, text messages that demonstrate widespread collusion by the generic drug manufacturers to artificially fix prices and to raise them. That's illegal. Everybody knows that. And I have emails, text messages, testimony, diaries, phone records that show that generic drug manufacturers are talking amongst themselves and colluding to divide market share. Hey, you can sell to CVS. I'll sell to Walgreens. Let's not compete with each other and everybody wins. That's also highly illegal. You don't have to go to law school to know that. Major companies cannot collude on price and they can't collude on market share to prejudice consumers, but they do and they get away with it. People ask me, this is shocking. How can they get away with it? The answer is, because if banks were too big to fail, these companies have gotten too big to care. I think it's just become a routine part of making money in this business. And there isn't enough accountability, meaning there aren't enough of us to say, you just can't do that. Mm-hmm. What shocks me is how brazen this is, right? It's not circumstantial evidence. It's not something that I've pieced together and you can infer that this is happening. I have the goods. And they still tell me, not true. We're not doing it. You're under indictment by the Justice Department. You've entered into a settlement, you know, with the Justice Department admitting this wrongdoing. Yeah, General Tong's wrong. Every action that we're taking, and we're talking about the tip of the iceberg. There are so many other regulatory rulemaking actions in front of the various federal agencies that touch in the healthcare system that we're engaged in. There's so much going on, and every piece of it is important and every bit helps. You know, the Affordable Care Act litigation, that's us. My colleague, unfortunately, in Texas, and a coalition of 18 attorneys general have sued as proxies for the president to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And they're not successful yet, but that case is in the Supreme Court. And I'm joined with a coalition of attorneys general defending it, because there isn't a good answer about what replaces it. You know, God bless if they're successful with 340B, frankly, because there isn't a good answer about what community health centers are going to do if we don't have access to 340B. All of these are profound risks to the healthcare system and to families and individuals in our communities. And let me just say one more thing. This is a healthcare talk and not a policy or politics talk. But number one, I think most of us understand how important this election is. So you got to vote. Get out there and vote. It matters to the healthcare system. You want to talk about what you can do? Vote. Okay. To drive down the cost of healthcare. That's number one. But number two is, even if we all vote, the election goes off without a hitch, that doesn't mean everything goes back to being great tomorrow. Okay. Tremendous damage has been done to the healthcare system, right? We'll still have all of these issues. The opioid crisis doesn't just go away. All of these initiatives are not only important, but they're ongoing, and they will be ongoing for some time. That's why we just have to hunker down and fight these fights.
Thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you both.
Connecticut Attorney General William Tong with podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Conversations on Healthcare is produced by the Community Health Center of Connecticut. You can follow their podcasts at chcradio.com. Next on Main Street, we'll remember Hiram Drucki.
Hey, Prairie Public, I'm Jake Throkill, host of the Magic City's late night show, Good Night Live.
How's everybody doing tonight?
You know it, you love it, and backed by overwhelmingly popular demand, if businesses had Tinder.
You know, Chicago may have had Second City, but we're proud to be North Dakota's third city comedy troupe.
Jake, we're fourth in population.
Nah. Well, good comedy comes from places that have a chip on its shoulder.
Minot's own Dizzy the Clown was recently installed as the president of the International Shrine Clown Association. Dizzy, if you're looking for a side hustle, Minot's looking for a city manager.
So to make up for that supposed tower work in Minot, Prairie Public is sending Main Street's Ashley Thornburg to be a guest on the show.
I work at a nonprofit, so you can definitely afford me.
Good Night Live, Saturday, October 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the original bar and nightclub in Minot. If you want to see the most serious comedy this side of the Mouse River,
Cirrus,
then join us at the original. Tickets and information at goodnightlive.com. It's a big show for a small town.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Hiram Drucki passed away on Saturday. Professor Drucki taught history at Concordia College from 1955 until 1991, and over the course of his life, he wrote 19 books, including one this year titled Retrospect and a Projection into the Future. For decades, he was a sought-after speaker about history and agricultural entrepreneurism in our region, across the country, and abroad. Our paths crossed several times over the years because he was producing books that told the story of our place and time. In 2013, he dropped by Main Street to talk about a book he wrote about the town where he grew up. It was a bittersweet remembrance titled, Where's Meriden? The Demise of Small Town USA.
You were born and raised in Meriden?
1924. And I was there until I went to high school. And then my mother said, what does it take to get a bus started? And they said 10 students. And so the bus company said, okay, and my mother rounded up 13, and we had a converted hearse for our bus.
So you went to high school in Owatonna.
Owatonna.
So we need to answer the question. Meriden is between Waseca and Owatonna, Minnesota. It's in the southern part of the state, and there isn't much of it left anymore.
One business left.
One.
If you want to buy a candy bar, a bottle of pop, you go to the vending machine at that business, because anybody else who gets food it's either brought in by a Swan's type of truck, Or otherwise, you go to Owatonna and Waseca, and most of the people work in those two towns unless they're retired.
Your name, Drake, is a German name. Yep. So when did the Germans come?
Most of them came pretty much from directly overseas. They stopped at Gutenberg, Iowa. Does that sound German too?
It does indeed.
Where the locks are yet to this day, and then came up from there. My great-grandfather came over. He was born in 1840 over in Prussia. My grandfather came over here in 1887 and looked around at age 16, by the way, and looked around a little bit and went back and got his widowed father and his sister and his three brothers to come on over. My great-grandmother was the first white child born in the township.
Ironically, your great-grandfather, Carl August Drake, actually had to register as an enemy alien.
Yes.
During the First World War because he wasn't a U.S. citizen.
Yep. He came over. He was old enough. He didn't feel that he would be any threat to anybody.
I grew up in a small town and my father was a newspaper publisher. And when I look back on those papers, the most entertaining stuff to read is the stuff that the community reporter was writing.
One weekend, I counted that there were 45 reports of people who had visited so-and-so and had a card party or a dance in their house. And then, of course, a sumptuous lunch was served at midnight.
Tell me about your early days in education.
I was lucky because the school that I went to was built in 1923. I had a two-room school, and of course we had toilets in our school. And I remember that after every recess, we'd stand the little grade on one steps and the bigger and the upper grade on the other steps, and then we'd take turns drinking from the fountain to go back to class. And the teachers both standing there watching, make sure that no one did anything out of line while they're standing on the steps waiting to get into their room.
The reason that Meriden was Meriden is because of the railroad and because of the farm economy that developed around it. So, Hiram, talk to us about how farming has changed in the 80-plus years that you've been witnessing it.
If you had been lived in Bible times and you came back in 1830, you would recognize all the tools and you could still farm. But if you had died in 1830 and you came back to farm in 1890, you wouldn't recognize anything because of the reaper, the plow, the seeders. Can you imagine going out and having to pull weeds by hand, having to hoe? Hired men and family and children from the family left the farms when it came to weed pulling time because it was just a job. You had to have a labor for about each 40 acres.
So you had to have a kid.
Yeah, you bet you did. And that's why the families were big. It was a built-in labor force, and there was no other choice.
That was Hiram Drake talking 7 years ago on Main Street about his boyhood home. During World War II, Drake served with distinction in the Army Air Corps before choosing a life in academia and research and writing. Among his many honors was an honorary Doctor of Letters degree from the University of North Dakota. From 1950 until 1981, Drake and his wife Ada also farmed outside Baker, Minnesota, where they were early adopters of innovations now common to modern agriculture. He is survived by his wife, a daughter, and two sons. Hiram Drake was 96 years old. Coming up on Main Street, a commentary by Mark Trahant, and a feature about a Fargo daycare that helps kids and families of new Americans adapt to their new home. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A statewide survey of North Dakota voters shows overwhelming support to invest the legacy fund within the state.
Pretty overwhelming in its responses here. 79-8 said they would support, with 68% saying they would strongly support that.
Chris Wilson is CEO of WPA Intelligence, the firm that did the research. His group asked state residents where they want to invest the $7 billion funds. He says there is overwhelming support to invest the money in North Dakota. Jamestown and Stutzman Development Corporation Executive Director Connie Ova says the results of the survey were clear. The people of North Dakota want the legacy fund to be invested in development projects in their own state.
This is remarkable, and it's something that we've been striving for years in economic development, is to get the point across that we need to invest back into North Dakota, into the economic development projects that we work so hard to find, and we need to invest in our own selves, at least a small portion. I totally believe the return on investment will be huge.
OVA says the survey could lay the groundwork for a statewide ballot initiative in 2022 when voters could add the words within the state to clarify the current constitutional language. She says that would require the State Investment Board to invest 100% of the legacy fund within North Dakota. Supporters of public works projects in Minnesota are looking forward to groundbreakings and other facets of a new statewide bonding bill. The Minnesota legislature approved the $1.9 billion plan last week after months of tense negotiations. It covers transportation improvements, water treatment plant upgrades, and other work. Megan Dayton of Minnesota Association of Professional Employees says there's also money to shore up funding deficits for Department of Human Services workers who provide direct care.
It keeps our members safe while they're at work. It gives them COVID testing, PPE protection while they're at work. And it also continues the care for the most vulnerable Minnesotans.
The bill also sets aside $116 million for affordable housing. Rhonda Otteson of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless says a number of shovel-ready development projects have been waiting on the funding. She says as more people lose their homes during the crisis, getting new housing started can soften the blow.
Whether it's supportive housing for people maybe transitioning from homelessness to permanent housing, or for people who are working in the community and at risk of losing their housing because they're paying too much.
Outside of the affordable housing funding, Otteson says homeless shelters need long-term investments from the state. She cites facilities across Minnesota in dire need of repairs and upgrades, as well as help with operational expenses. And North Dakota's not seasonally adjusted unemployment rate for September was 3.8%. That's down a full percentage point from August, but it's 2 percentage points higher than last September. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a seasoned reporter and editor. He leads the staff at the online news service Indian Country Today. He also presents commentaries about issues from a Native American perspective. And today's topic is the presidential campaign.
The Trump campaign had an outdoor rally in Arizona last week. It was a coalition of Native Americans for Trump, and the speaker was Donald Trump Jr. He talked about camping and fly fishing in the region and meeting with Navajo elders. The Native supporters credit the Trump administration with moving forward with a task force on missing and murdered American Indians and Alaska Natives, funding in the Coronavirus Relief Act, funding for public safety, as well as the recognition of several tribes, including Montana's Little Shell Band of Chippewa. In general, the Trump supporters say the Trump administration is a better bet for economic development. As Sean Redd, a Navajo businessman who has run for Congress, told Indian Country Today, Native values fit well within the GOP. Native people are very conservative by nature, he said. They believe in a lot of things that the Republican platform embraces, such as strong family ties, self-reliance, and liberty. The latest move by the GOP comes late. Democrats, on the other hand, began organizing much earlier in this election cycle. Earlier this month, former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris met with tribal representatives at the Heard Museum in Phoenix. A video by Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez asked the Vice President to send a message to the Navajo people. He replied, Navajo Nation, stay strong. We need you. We need you. We need you. We need you. Because you're going to have a seat at the table if we get elected. A seat at the table is very much a part of the Democrats' campaign effort. There are multiple public roles, Zoom events, and committee meetings that have included tribal leadership. The campaign also released a 15-page plan for tribal nations that includes, among other proposals, more economic development, healthcare improvement, and making it easier for tribes to acquire sovereign lands. The Democrats also call for investment in clean energy in tribal communities with a goal of net zero emissions in 30 years. The Democrats would bring back the White House Tribal Nations Conference. That used to be an annual event, but it's not happened during the Trump administration. There are several states, including Arizona, where the Native vote is larger than the margin of victory in the last election. The power of the native vote in Arizona has been reflected over the years in state races, especially the governor's office, and now both presidential campaigns see its significance. Speaking of breaking a record, more than 500,000 people have already voted in Arizona, and more than 28 million across the country. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Next on Main Street, a special daycare for the children of new Americans.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Benedictine Health System, helping seniors live fully with independent housing, assisted living, long-term care, and rehab services in North Dakota and Minnesota. BHSHealth.org.
Election Day is just around the corner. Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. Join me, my Prairie Public colleague Matt O'Lean, and NPR for a series of regional and national debates throughout the month of October. Our next one is a Prairie Public exclusive, the only governor debate in North Dakota between Republican Doug Burgum, Democrat Shelley Lenz, and the Libertarian Party candidate Duane Hendrickson. Listen Wednesday, October 21st at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Count on Prairie Public as your trusted home for fair election coverage.
Prairie Public Live Debate Coverage 2020 is sponsored in part by AARP North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Daycare centers can do more than keep kids fed and safe while parents work. They can offer preschool education. English language learners face an additional obstacle, and that prompted Rhoda Elmy to open her own center, which focuses on cultural competency for children new to America. The Jasmine Child Care and Preschool serves kids from 9 ethnic backgrounds. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talked with Development Director Skye Purden, who grew up in the U.S., Thailand, and Finland.
Skye, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, of course.
Do you know why Rhoda wanted to start a child care like this?
In 2015, Rhoda was invited by some families to come to Fargo, and in that, there's a conversation started about a need to have a multicultural child care center that would teach the children those skills, social-emotional skills and language skills and all these different skills that they needed to be prepared for entering school. And Jasmine Child Care started in 2015. We then switched over to a nonprofit because we really needed to help a lot of families, and this was better fit for our mission.
How is it different from other child care centers and preschools?
So after doing a lot of research, she found that there was a need to do an early childhood education program that could adapt the diverse population of Fargo-Moorhead area.
And when you say diversity, how many backgrounds do the kids that you serve come from culturally, linguistically?
Currently, we have between 8 and 9 different cultures represented among the kids. Our teachers have 4 different cultures that they know and languages they know.
So walk me through a day. What is it like for the students who come to Jasmine Child Care and Preschool?
So each day is quite similar in that the kids come in anytime after 7 a.m. They start coming in. The parents drop them off, and we have breakfast served for them. And then after that, they have circle time. They learn some lessons. We have a lesson plan, especially for the preschoolers, where they learn fine motor skills and then also cognitive practices. We use the SMART program to help the children use movement in engaging their brain to help them prepare for that learning. After that, they will use some time to listen to a book, read a book, and then talk about the story, and then practice writing their name. And then after that, we have time. We go outside. We like to give the children plenty of time outside. And then they have lunch. And after lunch, the kids will take a nap, snack, and some more playtime, and then the parents pick the kids up.
You mentioned the SMART program that's stimulating maturity through accelerated readiness training. Why the focus on that particular style of learning?
The children are exposed to the purposeful specific movement design to stimulate the mature areas of their brain necessary for success in school. And because our center is really focused on making sure that the children are prepared when they enter into kindergarten, we want to give them that additional cognitive development and also the motor skill development to make sure that they have all they need to enter school and be successful.
So by movement, that's what you mean, the motor skill area?
Yes.
Okay. And so what does stimulating that part first do? How can that boost, for example, reading skills?
When the child is doing these actions, it might be like a balancing or matching with crossing your hands, matching letters. Mm. It helps the child to activate their brain and to be ready to learn. So a lot of times we'll do these activities before we do a reading exercise. It helps them concentrate better because they are using the hand-eye coordination or visual perception.
So like me, sometimes I need to get up and run around some before I can concentrate on a book. Get the wiggles out.
Yeah.
You said that the kids represent 8 to 9 cultures, the teachers another 4. Are all of the classroom instructions and lessons done in English?
Yeah, so we have a infant room, toddler room, and a preschool room. Most of the formal instruction is done in the preschool room because we are licensed as a preschool as well as a childcare. The children will mostly hear other languages in between classrooms. So it might be when they're interacting with the teacher. For example, in our infant room, we encourage our staff to speak a variety of languages so that children can hear those languages and hear those sounds so that they're accustomed to it. So you might hear a little bit more of diverse languages in like an infant room where there isn't as much instructional teaching, where in the preschool room you're going to see more English because we are really helping them prepare for school. And school is in English.
Sure. Talking about the different languages that are being spoken throughout the day at the Jasmine Child Care Center, I'm wondering if you can talk about the importance of actually having somebody from that culture or a native speaker of that language. As an example, I speak pretty poor French, but enough that I could teach preschoolers some French, but I am not French. I am not from an Arabic-speaking country. I'm not from Somalia. When they're just little kids learning things like colors and shapes, why the focus on having someone from that area?
Culture is a very deep topic. And just because someone speaks another language doesn't mean that they understand the culture from that country, right? And so when we are talking about diversity and multiculturalism, we have to also recognize that there is diversity of thought, of worldview, of ways of doing things, ways of problem solving. And a lot of those things come through the interactions with the person of a different culture. Mm-hmm. It's not just about learning a different language. Language is so connected with culture as well. You may know how to say something in another language, but someone who is from that country would be able to show examples of how to use the language in an appropriate way or understanding the connection, maybe a cultural festival. They would be able to bring in different aspects of culture to pair with the language, because language really isn't isolated from culture.
We're speaking with Skye Purden. She is the Director of Development with the Jasmine Child Care Center and Preschool. This is a multicultural preschool located in South Fargo. And Skye, I'm wondering, tied up with culture, tied up with language, is a person's food traditions and their faith traditions. Now, obviously, these kids are very young. How do you address, we'll start with the easier one, the food traditions? Do you take the approach of you're living in the U.S., we're going to eat the way we eat in the U.S., or would you maybe, here's a young woman, you know, from China, and here's some food that she would find comforting, make it almost a show and tell event? I'm not sure how you do it.
We try to provide food that wouldn't be offensive to anyone. We try to find that middle ground where everyone will feel comfortable, and we do give cultural food. So a lot of the kids that maybe come from a more traditional background of not being used to some of the spices that other cultures maybe, they get an experience of learning to eat new types of foods, and a lot of them just fall in love with eating different foods. And that is a part of learning about diversity and learning about how there are different ways of doing things, different ways of enjoying food.
And I'll confess ignorance about this. A lot of cultures, and a lot of religions in particular, do have a head covering. And I don't know typically if that applies to the young children or if that's more so reserved for adults. Has that come up at all, or just, you know, when you have kids from different faith backgrounds, do you address that all within the scope of childcare?
I'm sure that we have conversations in classrooms as kids may ask curious questions. And so then we have those conversations as they come. And really at Jasmine, we try to help children learn positive views of each other and how to understand that maybe some people may not agree with us or we may not agree with some other people, but we can find that common ground and focus on those positives to give people room and understanding that sometimes also understanding that we may not fully understand something or why someone does something, but giving them that space to express their culture just like we would express our culture and that friend next to me would express their culture.
Yeah, and kids just, they're so curious and they're such sponges at that age. I know that you have only been with the center since January, but it has been open a number of years now, and I'm wondering if you get a lot of feedback and reaction from parents, and I'm thinking specifically of, for example, a kid comes and is a native speaker of another language, and then all of a sudden they're thrown in school in English. There might be a case of a kid is thought to be misbehaving in class. They're not sitting down or they're not being quiet, but maybe they just didn't quite understand the teacher. And with the focus really on getting them prepared for the classroom, have you heard reaction from parents, success stories in school?
We have heard stories of families and even teachers sometimes have reached out to us to say that they were really thankful that we prepared the children. And some of those children have really excelled. Instead of starting in kindergarten with zero language, they're able to communicate, understand instructions. They already know sitting down, waiting in line, all those social skills.
I noticed on the website for the Jasmine Child Care Center, the recent addition of overnight child care. How does the overnight child care work?
The overnight child care, currently we have planned to do it from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. We would have teachers that would, we would have the same ratio as during the daytime, but most of the activity would be kind of, you know, having dinner, getting ready to go to bed, and then just supervising the children while they're sleeping.
I bet that's really a different experience, though, for a kid to wake up and not be at home.
Interestingly enough, some things that we were talking about diversity in childcare and what it means to be a multicultural childcare. It's not just about having representation of different cultures, but also taking on different practices or methodologies. Mm-hmm. And something that we recognize is important is to know that there's kind of individualistic societies and collectivistic societies. Mm-hmm. And in a collectivistic society, which is a lot of the children that come to our center, come from collectivistic societies, which means that kind of the whole group is working together. So a lot of parents see us as an extension of childcare, right? Mm. We're also participating in the child's nurturing. And so many of the children that have come here for years, this is a part of their home too. They don't see it just as a childcare center, but they feel at home. And so for a lot of the clients that we would have during the night, they would develop that feeling of being at home. This would be like a second home to those children.
How has COVID impacted Jasmine Childcare?
We have remained open the entire time. We did receive some funding to help with the amount of kids that had to leave due to their parents being laid off or just being afraid of COVID in general. And so then for a time, we had a good chunk of our children stayed home instead of coming to the center. That has been a little harder with having less children attend, but we've been working closely with the child care, different child care resources, and also making sure that we're always complying with all of the regulations and all the updated regulations.
Your background, we had you on the show some years ago with an essay that you had written about being what's called a third culture kid. And if I'm remembering all the details correctly, you have one parent who is from the U.S. and one parent who's from Finland, but somehow you grew up in Thailand. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yes.
Okay. What is a third culture kid?
So a third culture kid is someone who grew up in a country that was different from their passport country or their parents' home country. So in my case, I didn't grow up in the U.S. or Finland. I grew up in Thailand. I don't have citizenship there, but that's where my childhood was. And so the experience kind of combines those, that home culture that I get from my parents would be a representation of the cultures that my parents are coming from. And then there's the culture that you learn by interacting with the people outside of the home. And so then as an identity, you kind of pick up on different cultural elements from all over the place. And you create your own, which is almost like a third culture.
Are there some social norms for here in North Dakota, in the Great Plains, that even though you look very much the part, seem a little funny to you because you didn't actually grow up here?
Yeah, so some of it I didn't realize until later some people would comment like, oh, you know, when I say, how are you, you answer honestly and completely about all the ups and downs of your day when all I'm saying is hello.
Right.
And so it took me a while to kind of pick up on that and realize, okay, maybe this person is in a hurry and they don't need to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
Another example would be food, practices around food. So here it's a lot on the go. We eat because we have to, where in a lot of cultures, food is an experience that you do with other people. For example, in Finland, coffee time is sacred. You take a break from work and you go and have coffee, and there's always something with coffee. In Thailand, it's a social activity. Food does not taste good alone. You have to share it with everyone, and you have to find someone to eat with. Otherwise, it just isn't food.
Skye, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Ashley Thornburg with Skye Purden, Development Director at the Jasmine Childcare and Preschool. You can find out more at jasminechildcare.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more, easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 21st. The Wild West was not quite as wild as the movies would have us believe. There were some shootouts, but not nearly as many or as dramatic as portrayed. Most of the events were embellished by popular dime novels and magazines like Harper's Weekly. There were also bank robberies with outlaws like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the Daltons, and the Cole Younger Gang. But bank robberies, too, were not that common. Between 1859 and 1900, there were fewer than 10 successful bank robberies reported across the entire frontier West. Uncommon as the robberies were, the thought of easy money still tempted desperados, and on this date in 1904, the Oaks Republican reported on the attempt to rob a bank in Lakota in Nelson County between Devil's Lake and Grand Forks. The citizens of the town were awakened by a loud explosion. Marshal Hurlett grabbed his gun and ran out into the night. He dashed in the bank, but he had to retreat when he was fired at. He rang the fire bell to call for help. The townspeople responded immediately, armed with revolvers and shotguns. An examination of the bank revealed that the robbers had blown off the outer and inner doors of the safe. The marshal had responded before they could open the inner steel box that contained the money. It was so badly damaged that it couldn't be opened, but the money had not been touched. Guests of the nearby Grace Hotel had also been awakened by the explosion and gunshots. When they went outside, they came face to face with the heavily armed robbers. The unarmed guests quickly retreated back inside the hotel. The marshal and the angry citizens were determined to catch the thieves. An impromptu posse chased the robbers, exchanging gunfire. The newspaper reported that several hundred shots were fired. In spite of the pursuit, the bad guys escaped. The marshal led an investigation the following morning. Tools that had been stolen from the local blacksmith shop were found in the bank. Several thousand dollars remained safely untouched in the inner safe. The robbers had disappeared, and there remains no record of an arrest. Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thursday on Main Street, October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Green Dot Bystander Intervention aims to help bystanders address domestic violence. And we'll talk about that with Sherea Robinson of Valley City Green Dot. October is also Dyslexia Awareness Month. We'll talk about that with Anna Hoover of Decoding Dyslexia North Dakota. And Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats to talk about popcorn and popcorn balls. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.